acquisition reforms are underway at agencies across government, but those efforts may be a waste of time unless stakeholders change some basic perceptions of the acquisition community. Kim McCabe is president and CEO of ASI Government, my guest on Industry Chatter today, and here's part of our special report, Trust Redefined, Reconnecting Government and Its Employees. And it's always a pleasure to see you, Kim. Thanks very much for coming in. You wrote a piece recently in GovExec that I thought was terrific, and I'm looking forward to the second of three. It's titled, Three Myths That Cripple Acquisition. Number one, government can be perfect. I don't think in this day and age anybody believes that government can be perfect, but we certainly have the expectation that they will be. And I wonder what that disconnect has done in your mind as far as how we will move forward and make progress on the big things we're trying to move today.
So thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
And congratulations on your affirmed President's Award.
Oh, thank you. That's very, very kind.
So, yes, this is the first in a series on govexec.com on the three myths that cripple acquisition. And the first is that government can be perfect. And I agree with you that it is really about the expectation that we have that it will be. And it can't be. And it won't be. And those expectations are unrealistic because they don't account for the need to acknowledge risk and determine our appetite for it. And the result of that is that mistakes are thought of and communicated as waste, fraud, abuse, and incompetence rather than, in many cases, normal course of business. And in the article, I really tried to argue that if we want government to succeed at the incredibly difficult things they do, and they do the hardest things, right? I mean, what government does is just extremely challenging, the biggest challenges with the greatest impact, really at scale. And if we want them to succeed at those incredibly difficult things that they're undertaking, we have to have a different conversation. And our politicals need to start supporting those who are making it happen, because our country cannot succeed if our public servants do not succeed.
You write in this piece, you make reference to a couple of private sector examples, and Steve Jobs is one. Of people who are perceived historically as being tremendously successful, and yet they had big blow-ups in their at various points in their careers. You mentioned the Lisa computer, which I had completely forgotten about, and the computer company that he started that Apple bought out. I remember the Apple Newton as not particularly successful, but I don't remember if that was a Jobs piece or if that was during the time he was away from the company. But at any rate, the perception is as big a part of this, I think, as big a problem here as the reality of it. And we have the perception now of healthcare.gov and the Department of Veterans Affairs scandals and all of these. And so I wonder how much of this you attribute to a perception problem and how much of it you attribute to a reality problem.
I think it's a taxonomy problem as much of it as a perception problem. Mm-hmm. So let's separate out both of those things you just said. So first of all, in terms of the expectations, they're based on our description and discussion about risk in large part. And there's really two types of risk that we're talking about. There's risks around experimentation, and then there's the risk of fraud, waste, abuse, and incompetence. And oversight is very focused on driving out, and I mean to zero, fraud, waste, abuse, and incompetence. But in both cases, the notion of driving risk to zero makes no sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of experimentation, it's impossible, and it's wrongheaded because you need to test and try and make mistakes and fail and try again and innovate and discover, and you need risk for that to happen. So we need to allow for and accommodate and discuss what our risk appetite is to allow for that, rather than pointing to the anecdote, right, the tyranny of the anecdote about the one thing or the things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of fraud, fraud is bad. Fraud, waste, abuse, and incompetence are bad. That said, there will be some in large programs, and what we do is very large. And it is impossible to drive it to zero, and it is prohibitively expensive to drive it to zero. The costs of rooting out that last dollar are incredible, and that is what we are doing, and we are having those conversations. So I think that, you know, so if you take an example, if you take federal financial student aid as an example, because I would expect that a listener is going to say, so are you saying that there should be fraud? Are you saying that we should expect fraud? And my answer is, I think that we should expect some fraud in large programs,
mm-hmm.
and I'll give you examples of that. In a healthy program, federal financial student aid historically has delivered tremendous benefits, but there's a certain amount of fraud in that. And we acknowledge that there's going to be some fraud, and we allow for a little bit of that fraud, although we try to drive it down. And what happens as a result of measuring it over time and contextualizing it is that the overall program is deemed as a success rather than pointing to the discrete one single case or certain number of cases that are fraudulent. I'll give you another really great case. I was talking to a friend of mine who's actually at the IRS, and he was telling me about a recent Treasury IG for Tax Administration TIGTA report. And the report was on the use of purchase cards, and it covered the fiscal years 2010 and 2011. In IRS, they made about 230,000 purchase card purchases, total spending of $103 million on the purchase card. GSA estimates $70 per transaction in savings and administrative costs from using the purchase card, which totals about $1.7 billion a year across government in savings. At that rate, the IRS saved $16.5 million from the purchase card use just from transaction costs alone over 2 years. Total fraud or waste that was identified by TIGTA was $7,000, of which $5,000 IRS does not agree with. And the actual inappropriate purchases was linked to a single individual who spent $2,600 on personal items, and by the time the report came out, that individual was gone. So that's one out of 5,241 account holders, $2,600 out of $108 million. So that's 0.002% fraud in the purchase card. But what ended up happening was we had a conversation about that, and that was what was in the media, and that's what was on the Hill. And so rather than looking at it and saying, hey, the purchase card is useful to us in terms of spending, in terms of our ability to buy what we need to in really effective and efficient ways, which we all want, we're focused on that discrete, again, the tyranny of the anecdote, that one anecdote about that one individual who spent that $2,600.
So you do understand, though, why it's a hard pull politically, no matter who's in power and no matter who has the chairs of these oversight committees, to expect that they're going to see that and not say, well, we should take a look at this. Now, when you drill down to it, I agree with you. The person's fired that did this, and it was one person and they're out. That's should be a sufficient outcome to whoever it is that's conducting the oversight. But you do see why that's a hard pull.
So I think it would not be as hard a pull if the interests of our politicals were aligned with governance, were actually aligned with the success of government, which I will tell you, I am not convinced they are. I am not convinced. There's very little demonstrable evidence that our political infrastructure actually wants government to succeed. Their interests are actually someplace else. But in the cases, to your point, where you actually align those who are in government, in the agencies, in large programs, with the interests of the politicals, and are able to come up with measures and identify the risk and the risk appetite, you see real benefits. So let's take the prison reform as an example. So in prison reform, that's exactly what happened. They've actually had some conversations between those who are implementing and the legislature. They've agreed that, hey, look, some bad things could happen here. It might be the case that someone will be let out early and something not good will happen, but we recognize that. We're going to allow for a certain amount of risk. We're going to try to drive that out to the greatest extent we can. But the importance of this program in terms of cost and social impact is so great that we need to agree that we're going to look at the overall program and the benefits of the overall program, and that's going to allow us to actually deliver the value to the citizen. And in acquisition, one of the reasons I wanted to write this is that in acquisition, we don't have a sophisticated way of talking about acquisition and procurements. So what's happening, it is every procurement or every contract or every program that is up for grabs versus looking at the broader potential impact of those large programs.
So how would a sophisticated way of talking about acquisition, though, change that when it's human nature and it's certainly political nature to go right to the worst example?
So I think that if we are aligned, if we agree that it is the case that for our country to succeed, our government must succeed, it really should be more like a Seabiscuit case. So it really should be more like we're actually rooting for the government to do well. And so there's several things that we need to do. And if our politicals really wanted our government and our public servants to succeed, they would do a very few things. One, they would set expectations that can be met. This notion of the risk that's in this article really talks about the fact that we don't even talk about the risk. We don't allow for risk in many, many cases. Second, we would communicate about good deeds as well as those anecdotes that I'm talking about. Third, we would support those who are doing the work. And the survey that you all did, which I thought was incredibly enlightening, one of the thematics in that is we're not treating that workforce well. We're not supporting them well. We're not honoring them and their work. And I think that that's the third thing that we would be doing to ensure that that would happen, because tone is set from the top, and we should expect our political representatives to help us to make sure government works effectively, in addition to driving out and driving down fraud.
We have to take a quick break, but before we do, define politicals. Are you talking about Congress? Are you talking about the political appointees of administrations, or a combination, or somebody else?
It is. I believe it is the Hill. I believe it is the politicals and the agencies. I believe it is the White House. I also think the media can help with this.
We'll talk more about that when we come back. Kim McCabe of ASI Government's my guest on Industry Chatter today, and we will continue in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My industry chatter guest today, Kim McCabe, President, CEO of ASI Government, and writer of Three Myths That Cripple Acquisition. Government Can Be Perfect is number one, and you can find a link to that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. What prompted you to want to write this series? This is the first of three, as we mentioned before. Why was this in your mind, Kim?
So I don't hail from the acquisition community, and I've spent 3 years in the Army as the Deputy Director for Transformation, from 2008 to 2011, the height of, you know, the two longest wars we've ever had, and had an opportunity to start working with acquisition professionals. And then when I came to ASI, which used to be Acquisition Solutions, and all ASI does is work with the acquisition community, I went more than an inch deep, you know, more like a mile deep, mile broad, and really started to get a better understanding of what was happening within this community. And there were some observations that came to me around the fact that it's a very fragmented community for a number of reasons, that they are very much back on their heels, and that there is no space to talk about what they aspire to be, even despite just incredible changing dynamics globally in so many different ways, which I'm actually going to talk about in my next article, so it'll be in there. And so started having some conversations with friends of mine in government and in industry about this, and created a conversation that we're now calling Acquisition of the Future. And as we talked about it, I really realized that there were some things that were holding us back from being able to achieve, to even talk about and aspire to, but certainly to achieve what the future of acquisition could be, considering the changing technologies, the net generation that are digital natives, the budget, you know, in terms of what's happening economically and social media. And so I wanted to put these out there to start a conversation about the fact that we really can do this, and here are some things that we need to get past to be able to have that conversation.
This first piece has been out for a while, and the second one is coming out soon. You told me before we started. What do you think of how the dialogue has gone, how the response has gone to this so far? Is it going the direction that you hoped when you created it?
In terms of the article?
Yeah.
Absolutely. For me, this is about us having the conversation. We need to be able to put it out there, very much like the survey that you all did. We need to start together as a community and as a populace and as patriots, having a conversation amongst ourselves and with our public servants and with our leaders and with those who are in political positions about how we can align ourselves to try to drive this country forward. And again, this country cannot succeed if the government does not, but this country can also not succeed if acquisition does not. Acquisition holds half of the discretionary budget and is essentially the front line behind the front line. So if they do not do well, we do not do well. So I really just want to start the conversation and get people engaged in thinking about it, and start to get past the, we have a problem and we can't get over the problem, it's too hard, and into, okay, so what could we be? And let's start talking about that.
So you write about risk and failure in this piece, and every time I think about or read about those two topics, I think of the old Thomas Edison story when he invented the incandescent light bulb. You know this story? And he had failed, they say 999 times. It seems very coincidental. But somebody said, well, you failed almost 1,000 times. No, I haven't failed 1,000 times. I just figured out 999 ways that didn't work. And I don't know if that's a true story or if it's ephemeral, but it speaks about the entrepreneurial spirit that I don't see anywhere in the government anymore, and is the kind of thing, as I go back in history and talk to folks who are around at those times, that got us to the moon and that accomplished some of the major things that we've accomplished in the past 100 years.
So I see it all over the place, and I think what we don't see is that it's touted, it's lauded, it's discussed, that we hold those folks up and we give them room, and we give them room to succeed and to fail. And that, again, comes in terms of the article. Part of what we're experiencing right now is everyone has their head down because they're so afraid of what happens if they pick it up. They are not allowed to take a risk. And being an entrepreneur myself, third generation, actually, and having owned three businesses of my own, you know that you've got to try and you've got to experiment and you've got to have a chance to really see what works, see what your customers need, determine what value you can add. As new technologies come in, try them out. Now, I'm not suggesting the government should be on the bleeding edge of all these new technologies. I am not suggesting that. But what I am suggesting is that there are a lot of people out there who I run into in government who really want to do different things. And by the way, this includes the politicals, okay? This includes administrators and commissioners, and it includes, political appointees as well as our public servants. I think that what we need to do is to start to give them the gift of some flexibility by saying, we're going to assign a risk appetite for experimentation, and we're going to support you as you do that by looking at those measurements and aligning our interests between the political interests and the execution interests so we can actually try to get something done that's new and different that'll move our country forward.
How do we find that right balance between being on the bleeding edge of everything where the risk is much higher and the zero risk position that you see us being in right now?
I think that we have to have a conversation that says, and this is another conversation I believe that is in a large part missing, what is the role of government now? What is the value of government now? What are the core competencies that government has to possess now? What should we make versus buy? And once you have those very important strategic conversations, then you can start to say, okay, so where is it that we want to invest? Where is it that we want to take risk? Okay, how much risk do we want to take? How much investment around that risk? When do we shut it off? When do we get concerned? How do we deal with the risk and mitigate those risks? As a CEO, I'm afforded that. To be successful, I'm thought of as a pretty good CEO, and many of my colleagues are as well, and it's because we're afforded that ability to go through that process and to then test some things out. Not everything that I do succeeds, as I'm sure my staff would tell you, but it is the case that our team is able to try, and our private equity partner helps us to invest in that and allows us to take those risks. And frankly, we've been able to do some incredible things as a result. So, and entrepreneurial things as a result of that.
How do you incent that strategic conversation then in a political environment like we're in right now? Not just congressionally, but the executive branch feels it too.
I think that the populace is speaking about how they feel regarding the direction of our country and how both the White House and Congress are currently supporting the success of our country as it's going. So I think that there is a basis for a conversation to say, we're not doing well, and frankly, you're not doing well. We can do better together doing this differently. So rather than thinking of political the way it is now, let's think of political as it has been historically, and let's start to move toward pushing the country forward together. That does not mean that there should not be oversight. That does not mean that there shouldn't be a concern about fraud. There is a difference between an actual problem, something bad that really happens and dealing with that, and trying to ensure that it never does. To me, those are very different things, back to your point from a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
And I think what we are obsessed with right now is trying to ensure nothing bad ever does happen versus both trying to drive us forward and dealing with those things that do happen that are not good things.
I will agree with you that the public is speaking about what they think about government to the extent that the way they respond to pollsters indicates that. President Obama's approval rating is as low as it's ever been throughout his entire administration, and Congress is just barely above talk radio hosts for approval ratings. I mean, we're right underneath. We're holding them up. That's the least we can do. Beyond that, nobody seems to be that upset about it yet. President Obama was reelected. Most of Congress of both parties that runs for reelection up into the 80s, 90%, is reelected time after time again. So it becomes a case of we don't like any of the other guys or ladies, but our guy's just fine. Again, I guess I'm still stuck on the incentives because the people speak broadly, but not specifically yet.
So I think the people need to speak specifically.
Mm-hmm.
That's an incentive. But I also think that your point is a really interesting one because I agree with you that it is not actually being demonstrated. There's the empirical evidence around this is really hard to find. That said, when I talk to my friends, and maybe this is true for you as well, what I hear is more that they just don't know what to do. It's just we're so behind, and we don't know how to actually make an impact anymore. And when we look at the system, it doesn't seem like even as an individual or even as a small company that we can make the kind of difference we want to. So the reason to have this conversation, the reason to write this series, the reason to start Acquisition of the Future, the reason for us to start to aspire to the next thing that we can be so that we can move ourselves forward is so that we can start speaking. We need to actually vote. We need to, and vote the way we mean, because really, I think that that is what's going to allow us, and, you know, public servants make up a pretty good chunk of the environment here where we live. These folks actually could speak up and they could make a difference in terms of how they are supported and incented and how those expectations are provided to them and the communications that occur and how much entrepreneurial spirit is allowed and so forth. So I agree that that's a really critical part to this.
Mentioning communications, you talked earlier about the need to communicate about good deeds. And when I was down at the Management of Change conference earlier this week, part of the conversation revolved around the fact that, well, good stories aren't sexy and they don't sell and on and on and on. And there was a gentleman, I believe, from DHS who said from the stage, the media doesn't want to hear about success stories. And I apologize for not remembering his name, and it's a shortcoming on my part. But David Bray, the CIO at the Federal Communications Commission, said, with all due respect, that's not the case. And he cited us and other media outlets as in the government trade press as places that these success stories can be told. And I unfortunately had to point out that the last time that somebody approached me from an agency and said, we have just had this system deployment or we've had a program completion and it's finished on time and it's finished under budget, would you like to talk to somebody about it? The last time that happened was never. That's never happened in the time that I've been at this radio station. And so I think it's incumbent on the agencies as well to say, you know what, we're doing good things and we shouldn't just keep that to ourselves because they're handicapping themselves from letting these stories exist as a record so that when, just take for example, healthcare.gov blows up, there's no body of work anywhere where people from HHS or other agencies have been saying, here's a project that we did that worked well, and then the bad ones become anomalies instead of being accepted as the standard operating procedure. What will it take, do you think, to get something like that to happen?
So I couldn't agree with you more. I think that I hear a lot, you know, we don't have leadership. And I think right now it is very, very hard to be a real leader. I think that's true across the board, but particularly in government. And I would say that what's happening is, and I think with all best intent, that we've become lawyer-led, not leader-led. And that is because of the risk issue. So there is such a fear of being dragged up to a hearing because of the anecdote of whatever the one thing was or, you know. So healthcare.gov is a great example. So it is one thing that happened, and it is a terrible thing, and it is very frustrating to all involved. That said, it is one thing. And so the question becomes, okay, what am I going to get called out for? I don't want to get called out. It's my career. It's my personal, you know, my personal reputation. So, again, not assigning risk, not being setting the expectations, and not actually using all the tools at our disposal is causing, you know, causing us a significant issue. If we could rely on our leaders, if our leaders felt confident that they could lead the way I believe they are capable of, and I see it, I know so many of these leaders in government, civil servants and politicals who are, they are patriots and they want to do good things, but they are being told not to raise their heads up right now. And the same is true in terms of being what Roger Baker from the VAA, when he left, he actually said, you know, leaders need to be risk absorbers. Mm-hmm. They need to be risk absorbers for their people, and they need to lead and make these decisions and be willing to come forward and talk about the great things that their agencies are doing. And again, I think we need a more sophisticated way to have conversations about those stories in the acquisition community specifically.
Shameless plug, Roger Baker's on the Federal News Countdown tomorrow. He's chosen his three most important federal news stories of the week, and he's going to be in here along with Jim Williams Shambach Williams, the new consulting firm they started. Kim, I wish we had more time. We've already gone over, but it's terrific to see you as always. Congratulations on this. I'm looking forward to the second one already, and thank you for coming in talking about this
Thanks
work with me today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Kim McCabe's the president and CEO of ASI Government. Her latest work in GovExec is Three Myths That Cripple Acquisition. Number one, government can be perfect. You can find the link later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.